Kia ora and welcome back to Build Aotearoa, episode 10. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh. This week I attended a brand seminar titled Building for Our Changing Climate. Now, Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, where I attended, was the last stop on the brand seminar tour of the country. And I was encouraged to think that there had been rooms of designers, builders, product suppliers, building officials, and a whole bunch of others who were interested enough in this topic to take around 4 hours out of their work week. A key takeaway from the seminar for me was that we're not prepared. We're already handicapped by having insufficient standards in our building code to deal with our current climate. Well, but with the forecast being warmer and wetter, the situation is set to get worse. Because we are getting wetter. Now, the first part of the seminar was mainly about water and keeping it out of buildings. And there are a few aspects to this. Firstly, we need to consider where to put our houses. There are some useful resources for looking at flood and inundation zones around Aotearoa and some tools for looking at the likely risk of sea level rise in certain areas. I'll put a few links to these in the show notes, but it is kind of sobering looking at flood maps and inundation zones, particularly if you live near the coast or by water, which is most of New Zealand. There are also forecast to be longer periods of warmer air temperatures. So combined, this means heavier rainstorm events because warmer air can hold more water and therefore a warmer atmosphere can generate heavier storms. Now we need to take into account and remember all the lessons we've learnt pretty much the hard way dealing with what was termed leaky buildings or the leaky building crisis. And we need to learn those and ensure that our homes are capable of withstanding rain coming from all directions. Because this is an interesting thing about water is that we tend to think of it running downhill, which is how a lot of the lapping occurs on our building makeups. We tend to lap things from bottom to top so that the water runs off or sheds with gravity. But we also have to appreciate that water can do weird things because it's kind of sticky and it's got this thing called surface tension, which means that it can go upwards if you have capillary action. And that's why we have things like capillary gaps or certain small gaps that are required at the bottom of cladding and in between pieces of cladding. All sorts of areas that are actually designed gaps that may look a bit weird the first time you see them. And I know that there have been issues where some people have actually sealed up too much, not understanding that some of those gaps are designed to be there to avoid this tendency of water or the ability of water to travel uphill with capillary action. We also need to account for what's called wind-driven rain. If you've been in Wellington or live in Wellington, you'll be familiar with horizontal rain. We need to appreciate that rain very rarely falls straight down, but can often come in sideways, carried by strong winds. So the outside of our buildings need to accommodate all of that and be capable of withstanding water coming from all different directions. But we have learned those lessons, like I say, the hard way in a lot of cases, and we've come up with some pretty reasonable ways of keeping water out of our buildings, as long as it's designed right and built correctly. There's also the issue of humidity, and this is set to get worse because we are going to be experiencing warmer conditions for longer and the atmosphere is going to be wetter. So the combination of more moisture, warmer temperature is going to bump up the humidity. So the second part of the seminar session included a discussion about internal moisture. And this is the often forgotten younger sibling to the clause E2 in the building code. So E2 is to do with external moisture and keeping that out. E3 in the New Zealand building code is the one that deals with internal moisture. And it's pretty slim, really, at the moment, and in my view, really needs to be upgraded to deal more with moisture that's in the air. it's mostly focused, E3 is mostly focused at the moment on things like tanking in bathrooms and liquid water and making sure that that doesn't get down into the floor or onto the framing. But it doesn't deal well with the huge amounts of moisture that we generate from breathing, cooking, bathing, showering, all the activities that occur inside a home and also underneath a home. If you're on a suspended timber floor, that can be a huge source of moisture. So we need to do a much better job of ventilation to cope with moisture. And we also need to be able to warm the inside of our homes efficiently. Dealing with ventilation and efficient heating will drastically improve the internal conditions because that'll help dry out our homes essentially. Ventilation is woefully inadequate in our building code. I've covered that before. I'll probably cover it multiple times again because the clause that deals with that G4 essentially just requires you to have openable windows, and there's plenty of evidence that that does not work. Even if it did work, it requires a lot of operation by the occupants, by the homeowner. Brands actually did cite an example where they studied this, and they ran an exercise and put some monitoring equipment in the house and measured how effective it was. And to be effective, and assuming reasonable outdoor conditions, i.e. not too hot, not too cold, not too windy, not too calm, they got the occupants of a home to go around, start at one room, and start opening all the windows. Just every single window, leave it open, open it right up, walk around the house, and then continue to back where you started, and then close them all. And the idea being that by the time you get all the way around the house, the windows, you've opened enough windows at the same time, and those windows have been opened wide enough and have been opened for long enough that you effectively do a full flush of all the air in the home, and you allow enough fresh air to come in. Now, if that air that's coming in is colder, and it usually will be for most of the year, it will nearly always be drier. Now, it gets a little bit complicated because we have to start talking about the difference between relative humidity and absolute humidity. But essentially, colder air, even if it's as much relatively moist, so has the same amount of relative humidity as warm air, because the warmer air can physically hold more water, then if we bring colder air into the home, it is by definition drier. It's displacing that warmer, moister air and actually getting rid of moisture. Sounds counterintuitive, and there's a good reason why people don't want to do that, because it's cold air and we don't want to bring cold air because we feel uncomfortable when we do that. But that's why the combination of ventilation and heating is effective at reducing the internal relative humidity and the moisture inside our houses. But you've got to do both. And we struggle a bit with the warming, and we definitely struggle with the ventilation. The third piece of that puzzle is thermal bridges. And we're only just becoming aware of that, because as we're improving the level of bulk insulation, as we've just done with H1 clause, that's the energy efficiency clause, we've ramped up quite dramatically the amount of insulation required in most of our houses. That means that the bits that aren't very well insulated, like the corners or wherever there's timber through the frame, or those beautifully highly conductive pieces of aluminium that we use to hold the glass that forms our windows, that aluminium frame around the windows, that conducts heat really, really well, which means that if there's no thermal break there, then the temperature on the inside of that metal frame is pretty close to whatever the temperature is outside. And if you happen to be in the South Island on a winter's morning, and that can be pretty damn cold on the inside of that metal frame. Now, all of those areas are thermal bridges, and they are great locations for condensation to form. They're basically little dehumidifiers because they just drop all of that moisture from the warm air that hits that cold surface, just like the outside of your cold beer that you've taken out of the fridge, and then it starts to run with condensation on the outside. That's the same effect that's going on the inside. And we can see that clearly on the inside of our window frames, but the same effect will be happening on the inside of your walls, where there's a colder surface and warm air might be finding its way through to that cold surface through power points or cracks or junctions if your house is not airtight. And that's the benefit of airtightness, is it stops that warm, moist air from finding its way to a cold spot within the wall. Because, like I said before, if that condensation occurs for long enough inside a wall and you get mold growing, then that's actually worse, I think, than the mold you can see, because it's growing and you can't see it and you can't really do anything about it. But you're probably going to start to eventually smell and feel the effects of that mold, certainly when the mold dries out and the spores become airborne. So that's a long way of saying that our building code is pretty well equipped now to deal with water, keeping water out of our buildings from the outside, but not so much with dealing with the moisture inside. And I think there's a cultural importance, or there's a cultural difference there as well, because our designers, our building officials, and certainly our home buyers are so acutely aware of all the issues of water getting in, because people getting sued and hearing horror stories of people losing houses, losing their life savings that are tied up in a home because of the leaky building crisis. So we're very, very acutely aware of that issue. We don't need to scare people, but we definitely need an awareness of a similar risk that is occurring from not appreciating the effects, the potential effects of moisture from the inside of homes. So there are some areas of improvement that we need to be aware of. And these include a more consistent approach to how we plan where we're going to build. We should avoid floodplains and inundation zones, and we need to deal with internal moisture and overheating and ventilation much, much better. Which brings me on to compliance, and this was also addressed through some of the questions. So just stepping back, talking about compliance with clauses in the New Zealand Building Code, there are a few different ways of achieving compliance. Generally, there's what's called an acceptable solution, and then there's a verification method. Acceptable solutions are easy. They're easy for designers and they're easy for compliance officers. There's no calculation required. And if we look at H1, energy efficiency, the acceptable solution simply involves pretty much looking up a table and checking the required insulation R value for the appropriate climate zone. And as long as the insulation is specified and installed to meet at least that R value, then the solution is deemed to comply. And this simplicity is attractive because very little thinking is required from the designer. And it's also very quick and easy for the compliance officer to see if the R value is equal to or higher than what's required. And if it is, they can sign it off. Verification methods, on the other hand, require a little bit more work. And again, in the case of H1, there are two options, a calculation method or the modelling method. Now, there are some very good reasons for taking the extra time required to do an energy model, or at the very least, a comparative calculation. The main reason, as far as insulation is concerned, is that by simply following the acceptable solution, there's a risk that you're over-specifying roof insulation. By doing an energy model, you can actually consider the whole building and optimize the levels of insulation around the whole envelope. Maybe it's a better option to up-spec your window slightly so you reduce those thermal bridges, and you'll find that the overall heat demand goes down and you don't need R6.6 in the roof. One of the things that came up kind of as a sidebar, but just as a, some of the research that's going on to build better for various reasons, was warm roofs. Now, I'm not going to get into warm roofs in detail here. That's probably a topic for another article, another episode. But suffice to say that brands are quite enthusiastic about warm roofs. I'm quite enthusiastic about them for a bunch of reasons. I know that other designers tend that way if they're looking towards better performing homes. In fact, it's certainly the way that a lot of European design has gone, for good reason. And a lot of passive house designers end up going down that pathway as well. Now, a warm roof has a very similar construction to a wall, but just on an angle. And it has a fairly similar dimension. So warm roofs are typically around 300 millimeters deep, maybe 350, 400 millimeters deep. So definitely not as deep as a large truss that you would find in a standard New Zealand house today. So someone put their hand up and said, all well and good building a warm roof, but how do I get R6.6 into that depth of roof? Now, the answer to that question should have been a very simple one, which is you don't need R6.6 in the roof. And that was answered in a roundabout way, and I've often said that to people as well, but it often results in a bit of confusion by the person asking the question. This happened recently when I pointed it out in a LinkedIn post. And what I said was, if you're putting R6.6 in the roof, especially here in Auckland, then you're either being lazy or you're intentionally over-insulating your roof to compensate for inadequate insulation somewhere else. And in my book, neither of these are what I would call acceptable. So essentially, you need to have a think about why you're just jumping straight to the acceptable solution. And people assume that the code is R6.6. It's not, because the code is not the acceptable solution. The acceptable solution is not the code. Energy modeling is the best solution for optimizing the insulation requirements around the whole building. It used to be something that was hard to do, complicated. You'd have to go and get a specialist. You still do need to get someone who knows what they're doing, but it's become a lot more accessible. Today, there are some great tools that are easily available. For standalone and terrace houses, it's pretty hard to go past the Green Building Council's Energy and Carbon Calculator for Homes, ECHO, which is based on the Passive House Planning Package, which is known to be a very reliable energy model, particularly for it's a relatively simple heat loss calculation. It's not a dynamic model, which you would need to step up to if you've got a higher risk of overheating, or you've got a more complex design like an apartment building and you need to do dynamic simulation with different zones that might have some temperature variance. That all sounds very complicated, but again, there are people that out there who can do that stuff. And if you're spending millions, which is feasible, on a larger building project, then why wouldn't you spend a few thousand dollars getting this stuff right and optimizing the design, not just for the benefit of your occupants and the ultimate building owner, but you might actually find that you'll save on some of your products and materials on the envelope, because that's the whole point of optimizing. It's figuring out how to lay out the building, what size and specification to have the windows. All of those things, and the air tightness is a critical piece of that puzzle, that may allow you to actually come up with a cheaper solution or a more cost-effective solution for a much better outcome. So I just really encourage people to spend a little bit, invest time and a little bit of money on some expertise up front with energy modeling, because you'll find that you'll get a much better outcome, and it's going to be a much better result than just relying on the acceptable solution. Just down from energy modeling is the calculation method, which is the next best option. There are some great tools available for that. Most of those are free, and a great one there is the H1 calculator, which you can find on the New Zealand Green Building Council website. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. And while I'm talking about the Green Building Council, if you are interested in learning some energy modeling, then you can do the Homestar Designer course and learn how to use Echo, and you get a license for that as well. You don't have to be an engineer or a building scientist to do that. The training covers a lot of the fundamentals of building science, and it's a great course for getting designers and architects up to speed with a really accessible and very useful New Zealand-specific energy modeling tool. Just a final note on calculating carbon, because the seminar was focused on dealing with the impacts of climate change. We're starting to grapple with the reality of what's coming. But there was also a brief mention of the proposal by MB under a previous government to implement something called the Building Climate Change Program. Now, given that we're already a third of the way through 2024, we would need to get a bit of a move on if we're going to be anywhere near on track for accounting for carbon in buildings and contributing to reducing the causes of climate change as set out in the adoption schedule for that Building for Climate Change program, which had some pretty pretty big targets to hit in 2025. I guess that's not really on the agenda at the moment. Oh well. So that's my little summary of the Brands seminar, Building for a Changing Climate. I think there's definitely an acceptance that things are changing. So this seminar was definitely focused more on realizing that things are going to change and the fact that we're going to have to deal with that. It wasn't about reducing impacts as much. That is an important part that we've got to take into account as well, reducing the energy demand, because that reduces the operational carbon. And we also are getting better tools and better understanding of reducing embodied carbon as well. But this seminar was definitely more about keeping the water out, dealing with moisture that's in homes, improving ventilation, addressing the fact that we are generally underheated during winter. Didn't talk a lot about overheating, but that's going to be an issue as well. There was quite a lot at the introduction about the fact that we're going to experience hotter days and longer periods of hotter temperature. And as I pointed out previously, that's another area that our building code is completely silent on. So that needs to be addressed as well, fairly urgently, I think. All right. Well, that was it for me. Bit of a rant, bit of an overview, bit of a commentary of some of the stuff that's going on. I guess just before I go, the other final thought was that the content of these seminars is fantastic. It's really good. Probably one of my main concerns is that while it's great to see probably 100 or so people in the room there in Auckland, we really need to get this stuff out to thousands. We need to be teaching people all of this stuff who are doing architecture, learning architecture now. It certainly needs to be taught to all building officials across the country, because they need to be aware of this stuff and encouraging designers to not just go with the bare minimum acceptable solutions. And we need to make those higher performance solutions more of an easier pathway, because at the moment the path of least resistance are the acceptable solutions, because they're so easy for everyone. So there's not much of an incentive to go above and beyond that to produce a building that actually works well. So we need to figure out how to do that. Ultimately, I think we need to change the building code. That's it for me for this week. Thank you very much for tuning in. Love to get your feedback. Thank you for the people that have emailed in with some questions and some suggestions. You can contact me, matthew@homestylegreen.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks very much, and I hope to be back again soon on this Homestyle Green feed with another episode of Build Aotearoa.